Real.
Real.
Relaxed.
Relaxed.
But relevant.
But relevant.
She's an absolute professional with a homegirl feel. Welcome to the Bishop Mary Show with Bishop Mary Foy Palmer, where she will discuss both religious and secular topics with various guests from all walks of life. So thanks for tuning in to the Bishop Mary Show. And now, here's Bishop Mary.
All right, I'm your host, Bishop Mary, right here. Happy Memorial Day. It is May 31st, 2021. And thank you so much for tuning in and listening to the dynamic show we have for you today. We're going to talk about mental health, the public and the church, with two dynamic guests. But first, a word from our sponsor.
Hi, I'm Kimberly Davis, Senior Executive Vice President with the National Hockey League. We're proud of the wonderful efforts of our new partners at the Community Healing Project for All to provide community healing, especially to our young people. In addition to providing a free educational resource to children with our in-home and in-school STEM curriculum called Future Goals, we are excited about the communication tools called Healing Posters. We hope that every time a child sees these wonderful signs in a window, they are reminded that they are loved, valued, and have great purpose. So join us by calling or texting 833-722-4748 and leaving your contact information. Together, we can work to battle our children's many challenges to education and bring a message of hope.
Conquering the senseless violence we face is hard because we're not connected. We don't communicate. It seems like we don't even care. We're waiting for the mayor, the commissioner, the clergy. But you can unite your block with our posters that say, "Not my block, not my child," covered in prayer, and let the healing begin. Give one of our free healing posters to each of your neighbors to open lines of communication and let them know that somebody cares. Visit us today on Facebook at Community Healing Campaign or order by calling 833-722-4.
Today I'm delighted to have a really good friend of mine and one of the premier professionals in the city of Philadelphia leading in mental health capabilities is none other than Dr. H.G. Wright.
Good morning, Bishop. Good morning. I'm so glad to be with you.
Would you mind telling everyone what role you have and how and why you chose the profession in mental health?
So my current position with the city is I am Director of Behavioral Health and Justice Division under the Department of Behavioral Health and Intellectual Disability Services. So that's the main thing that I do. And then I'm also, for the last 10, almost 11 years now, been an adjunct professor and clinical faculty at Temple University in the Department of Psychology, where I supervise doctoral students and also teach undergrad class and also a couple of graduate classes. So,
but let me just ask this. Why is there such a stigma in our community specifically?
It's a great question, Mary. And really, it's most things are with us, it's historic. When I say we, I mean those of us that maybe are in the middle age group and we've heard stories from our grandparents and maybe if we're fortunate enough, a great grandparent or two about the Tuskegee experiments. And how Black and brown people were used as, quote unquote, guinea pigs in that time back then. And not just that time, that's the most famous time, but there have been other incidents where people of color were disrespected from the standpoint of being studied as opposed to being treated as participants that had valuable information to share. And then you add to that the fact that there are not many physicians, researchers, healthcare professionals at the highest level that do this kind of research when I talk about health and social determinants that look like us. We're about 12 to 13% of the population overall in the United States. And we have physicians that are about 2.5% of physicians are people of color, and even less than that in the researcher realm, pharmacists realm, that kind of thing. And so basically, in short, African-Americans, Black and brown communities do not see a large representation of themselves in that field. And so we have a distrust when people that do not look like us are studying us, have had a history of not treating us properly, of overdiagnosing, those kind of things. And then you have the old adage of, you know, what happens in mama's house and grandmama's house stays in mama's house and grandmama's house. And so, you know, you're not trying to talk to no stranger about what's going on. And so although we may feel the stress and the pressure that comes along with being Black and brown in America, we don't always want to talk about it to folks outside of our own community. And let's be frank, we're not always willing to talk about it with each other, because if we don't have solutions, we end up feeling bad and you know, the man this and the man that. And the next thing you know, you get into a venting session that really ends nowhere. And so folks just put their head down and keep it moving. And so and then the last thing I would say is, we also have that stigma of we don't want to be called crazy. We don't want to be labeled. Wow. We don't want to be anything vulnerable or weak. And all those definitions come from a misunderstanding about the strengths of people that have behavioral health challenges. We all are dealing with something, and that it's okay to not be okay. And so when you put all that together, Mary, folks in the Black and brown community, we kind of keep things close to the vest, if you will. And we're not trying to share a whole lot. And we certainly do not understand the resources and the supports that are there for us. And so when we don't understand something or we are suspicious of it, we avoid it. And that's what I see is going on in our communities.
Given what we have now experienced historically and now COVID, mm-hmm. what are some things that you could suggest to those of us who feel, I can't say I'm not okay. I might get fired. I'm a pastor, police officer, I'm a nurse or a doctor. What are some of the other measurements that those that are around them with support systems or things that you could suggest that would help us to feel that there's a safe place
yes.
and a safe space for mm-hmm. people to really face their concerns?
Sure. Yeah, it's an excellent question. And so I'll answer it this way. First is in something that I like to share with people in cognitive psychology, we have the three A's. First one is awareness. The second A is acquisition of knowledge, or just finding out, learning. And then the third one is application. And so for those groups that you mentioned, some of which you mentioned, and there were first responders, police, fire, you know, I consider pastors, faith leaders in general, first responders. I consider teachers and educators first responders. Because just like fire and police, when there's danger, when there's something going on, pastors, you all run to it. Y'all don't run away from it. And sometimes you may be wherever you are in the congregants or parishioners, or in some cases, just community members. They're going to reach out to faith leaders before they reach out to Dr. Wright. Trust me on that. And so when you need help, when there's a healing needed for the first responders that I just named, I would suggest, first of all, that you acknowledge the fact that you have that first A already taken care of. It's called awareness. The next thing is arm yourself with information. And I would suggest you go to dbhids.org/boost. We're running a big campaign right now for individuals to access those services. Of course, everything's free of charge and it's anonymous. You know, we have something called healthymindsphilly.org, which also you can find through that same website. And it's Healthy Minds Philly teaches mental health first aid that is specifically designed for civilians, non-mental health professionals, you know, where you can get, and that's free. Again, you can take that one day training. You can find out a whole lot about what's going on, and you may see yourself in that training, or you may see a family member or a colleague or a friend. And it teaches you how to have conversations with people, not trying to cure anybody or save anybody or diagnose anybody, but just supporting one another. That's another thing. And so we have supports and we have resources available to folks. And then that third A is important. When you do all of that, you can't stop there. You actually have to apply the information and the learning that you've acquired, because many of us have information and we have awareness, but we are slow on that last A, that last point, application. We know to drink more water, and yet we don't do it. We know to exercise, and we say next week. You know, we know a lot of stuff, right? And so Black and brown people know a lot, and they have all kind of reasons for not applying it. What I would say is those of us who have benefited from applying the things that we know, we should wrap our arms around each other and that neighbor that may be a little skittish, little hesitant, you know, to do some things. that could be helpful to them. And so when I think about it, I think mind, body, spirit to you. So that's where I would start, is finding someone you trust. And if you don't have that, then there are certainly resources with professionals. But telling your story, acknowledging how you're feeling, acknowledging that it's real, it's not your fault. This is something that has happened to you. And that's a question that I teach people when I do my training, is stop asking folks what's wrong with them. You know, it's not, that's not the question. The question is, what happened?
Right.
What happened to you? Right. And certainly the example you gave with the Wallace family, that there's nothing wrong with anyone. Something happened and it continues, even though the incident may be over. Nothing is over as long as I continue to miss my loved one and we can't bring that person back. And there are families all over Philadelphia.
Yes, Lord.
And United States, unfortunately, that have that experience. And so for those of us like you and I who have a heart for this work, it's important first to let people know you have a story. It's your story. It's unique. And it is healing. But you have to be in a safe space, in a brave space, so that you can share.
Absolutely. You're an author as well. Would you mind telling us about your book?
Sure, absolutely. I am the author of Find Strength in Your Struggle, Discover the Miracle in You. And the purpose of me writing that book was really just going through my own struggle of spiritual disillusionment from time to time, and looking at and asking God the why question, you know, and how many of us have asked God the right why question? Well, I went further than that, Dr. Mary. I actually shook my fist at God, and I didn't just ask why. I had some choice words for it, you know. And and I'm
no,
so
not good. You.
Yes, I did. And I'm a preacher's kid. Yeah, I'm a preacher's kid, and I had some choice words. You know, but it's because of the relationship with God the Father that I'm so glad he has a sense of humor, number one, because I'm still living. You know, so he took my little tantrum, my little tirade, and he said, "Oh, look at my boy, look at him. Oh, he's upset. All right, let me reach down and comfort him." And what I learned through that process was that I had something to say that may be help to others. And that struggle is inevitable.
Right.
Struggle is inevitable. And I was frustrated with the struggle. I wasn't really frustrated with God. I thought I was. I was frustrated with the struggle because I was tired of the pain and I wanted something else. And what I learned in the process was find strength in your struggle.
Come on, son.
Because struggle is inevitable.
Well.
So it is an act of futility to try to avoid struggle and act like, oh, let me just find this smooth course in life. Well, you may have some smooth parts, but there's some rough edges. You know, there's some ups and there's some downs. And so why not spend my energy on finding the strength in it? How do I become stronger? How do I persevere? How do I take what has happened to me and turn it into something that can work for me? And then as I do that, I discover that miracle that is in all of us, that higher power that is more than just a name and more than just a belief system and more than just rhetorical language and words. It is action. And the action is that what I have been able to survive, now I can thrive. And when I am thriving, I do not continue to move forward on my own and say, well, that's good for me. No, I reach back and grab a brother and a sister. I reach forward and connect to people who need the uplifting that I have found. And so I discovered, Sister Mary, that the struggle is where the strength was.
Wow.
The safety is in the eye of the storm.
Come on, here,
the storm's
sir.
Coming. The storm's coming.
You better
coming.
Come through, Doc.
But the safety is in the eye of the storm. And so as I learned that by personal experience, I wrote it down. And so I have chapters in there that talk about the parent-child disconnect, because anybody that's ever raised a child knows you're not always connected. You know?
That's right.
And I talked to parents in that chapter about, hey, stop trying to be best friends with little Johnny, little Susie, little Tyrone, and
come
little
Lucretia.
You know, you ain't the friend, you the parent. You know, I talk about, you know, being the only God that children know until you introduce them to the God above. You know, the child don't know any difference at 3, 4, and 5. That's who you are. And then as they learn through you, you get through that. I talk about when Solomon talks about raise up a child in the way he should go. And when he is old, he will not depart from it. Well, let me tell you something. Let me tell you what Solomon didn't say. Solomon didn't say, and when he is old, he will not have acted a fool at one time or another. Solomon didn't say, and when she is old, she will not have embarrassed you once or twice. Solomon said, you put it in him, God will bring it out of him.
Come on, son.
I'm a witness that,
I know that's right.
Yeah, I'm a witness that, you know, God takes care of children and fools. And I was a grown man. So that is the thing that I wrote down, because it helped me to share my story of struggle and what helped me. And so what helped me won't help everybody, you know, but it helped me. And so I shared what helped me and helped people. And then the third thing I will say, the last thing is, I discovered that my problems seem far less intimidating and impossible when I took on a life of service. When I help others, and I'm not suggesting that my problems went away. I'm suggesting that in service, I had a new perspective of my problems. And I had more energy and I had more focus and I had more trust and confidence in the problem solver, which wasn't me. And so to me, when I stopped focusing on my own pity party, you know, and I give myself 24 hours to have a pity party, then you need to get over it, right? So, and move on. But when I started really serving others, it gave me a new perspective on an old problem.
Wow.
And but it's able to separate, you know, why do I think, and I asked my father this when he was still alive, I said, why me? My father, well, he took me, I thought he was going to go from Genesis to Revelation, but he didn't do that. What he did was he said, you know, son, I recognize something in that question. He said, I noticed you never say why me when you got into that graduate program. You didn't say why me when you closed on that house. You didn't say why me when the car note was paid and everything and it was working well. I noticed something, son. You only ask God why me when things aren't going the way you want. And I said, I had no words.
Right.
For that old man at the time. I just looked at him and said, okay, Dad, I got you. And so the whole point of me writing the book was to bring real experiences, real life struggles into the conversation that I hope others can relate to, reflect on, maybe see something in them that relates to them or maybe not. But there's something in that book for everybody, where you can say, you know, yeah, I recognize that struggle. And then understanding that the solution, the cure for spiritual depression, if you will, that was my first book, The Cure for Spiritual Depression, is actually service. It's actually service. And so that's why I did that. And so now I'll just share with you, since you gave me the platform, I'll just tell you that I'm working on my next one. It's called Healthy Pastor, Healthy Church. Who comforts the spiritual leader? The clergy on the faith leader, who, again, I've already told you, is a first responder, just like police, just like firefighters, just like school teachers. And so I wanted to do something in a supportive role for faith leaders, because you guys are on the front lines, especially in Black and brown communities, doing the work behind the scenes when nobody's looking. And so Healthy Pastor, Healthy Church, Who Comforts the Spiritual Leader is my next project.
But I am so grateful to have you today. I tell you, you have been a joy. Now, how can people get a copy of your book?
Sure. They can access the book at Dr. H. Jean, that's spelled J-E-A-N. There's an H in front of it, drhjean.com. Or you can go to Amazon.com, drhjean.com or Amazon.com. In terms of the mental health and behavioral health resources, it's dbhids.org/boost. And so that's dbhids.org/boost, B-O-O-S-T. And it's been a pleasure, and I'm always happy to be with you and see you. Hopefully next time we'll be in person.
Absolutely. I appreciate you, Dr. Wright. Absolutely. Thank you so much for being on the Bishop Mary Show.
Thank you.
May God bless you.
How do you feel? I know that you can hear me praying from the tops of the hills. I've been thinking about you and all that you do. Supply our needs with your presence. That's what you do. It seems to me that I am always begging you for this or that, not realizing that you're always faithful, and that's a fact. Good morning, Lord.
Written, produced, and exhibited and shared with us today. Again, good morning, Lord. And back with me by popular demand, because he got cut off on our last time together, it's none other than Mr. Robert Strother, better known as Bob Conga. How are you, sir?
I'm blessed in spite of all my mess, and I got a lot of that.
Boy, that's real honest. The last time we chatted, you were saying that you had been writing some songs for a while, but you're really a conga player. And so for the young people that are listening, why the conga? What is it in relation to you and our heritage that makes it such a profound instrument?
Well, when I first heard the instrument, I think I was like, 14, 15 years old. The first time I ever heard the instrument, and I was drawn to it. And I saw this guy, and I heard the sound, and it drew me to it. And I went there and saw this guy playing three congas, and I ran up to the guy, and I was so fascinated with it. I asked the guy to show me, you know, how was he doing that? So what he did, he turned his back on me because he didn't want me to see his hands. He didn't want me to see. So that was the first time I was really introduced to the instrument. And then when I went into service, and I had some time off, and I went in town, and I saw back in the day, we call them tack head drums. Those were the congas with the tacks on the round. And so you would have to heat it up with fire and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I bought it for $20, took it back to the base, sanded it down and painted it black. And I stayed on base for 2 years, just listening, practicing. And then I decided to, a friend of mine really got me out to go to the clubs. I didn't really want to go. But I went anyway, and I started playing, and I was playing with this group, and I told them that I would play for them for free if they just let me play, because I wanted to get my chops wet to see where I was going. People started coming out to see me, so I went to the leader, and I said, look, man, I said, you got to pay me now. So I know I was bringing the people in, so I said, you got to pay me now, you know. So he started paying me, so that's when I became a professional player back then. And I was just fascinated with the instrument because it's skin on skin. It was more personal, you know, even though I didn't have a stick or anything between me and the instrument. It was just my hands on the skins and producing different sounds, you know, by the positioning of your hands and all that kind of stuff. And the instrument took me really around the world.
Right, so what propelled you to write Good Morning, Lord, this particular song?
Well, I'm not really a traditional gospel singer. So what I try to do is write for me, for my voice.
Gotcha.
And I want to write for the Lord. I was sitting there and I guess it was the Holy Spirit, you know, said, well, why don't you write something about, you know, ask the Lord. You know, we're always asking the Lord for things. Ask the Lord how he feels. You know, so when that came across my mind, I said, wait a minute, that don't sound right. I said, you know, ask the Lord how he feels. I said, he's fine. I said, he don't need me. I said, what I'm asking him for, you know. So, but then I really started thinking about it. And I said, you know, I never heard anybody approach it like that before. So I always try to write differently and sort of stand out. And so I just said, okay. He said, come to his throne boldly, you know, so I'm coming to his throne. I'm asking you how you feel, Lord, you know. I know you hear me. I know you hear me praying from the tops of the hills. I know you hear me, you know, but I'm asking you, how do you feel? Because I'm concerned about my one and only King. And that's what inspired me to write that, you know, differently. And the other two songs, too, the other two things that are Who and You're Worthy, you know, those are the tunes that I truly believe that he is worthy. I'm not, you know, I don't deserve anything that he's done for me. I know that, you know, but he hasn't given up on me. You know, he's kept me through Vietnam wars. He kept me through when I was coming up. I came up with a dysfunctional family like most men do, you know, and I did the gang war thing and all that kind of crazy stuff, you know, and been shot at a couple of times and never went to jail, you know, and because my grandmother raised me. So I always tried to do good in school, you know, try to stay out of trouble that way. And he always kept his hand on me. You know, even when I was in the service, I almost died twice. He saved me. You know, he kept his hands on me. And my thing is, like, the only thing that you do for God is the only thing that's going to last. So my mm-hmm. thing is, like, I want to write whatever little talent that he's given me. I just want to be able to give it to him, you know, whether it's service. Like I heard the pastor was talking about service. And service is very powerful because I do volunteer and we feed the community, give out food, you know, a lot of churches do. I'm involved with the men group called Gabor. And come together and what we do is peel off those many layers that we're so comfortable hiding behind, trying to become more transparent, you know, trying to focus in on ourselves, you know, trying to figure out how can we be better husbands, how can we be better providers, how can we be better models, you know, for our children and neighborhoods, and just trying to, you know, make a difference, you know.
That's wonderful.
We all have an expiration date. We don't know when it is. God knows. So my thing is, I always say, like, I want to die empty. So whatever experience that he allowed me to go through, I want to be able to pour it into the next generation. You know, I have a young man now, he plays the steel drums, you know, and I keep trying to stay on him because he's going to be something to reckon with. If he stays in school and continues studies, he's going to be a powerful little guy. You know, I told him, I said, I wish I had those kind of directions. I didn't have that.
Right.
You know, and I try to give what I have. Right.
And I'm glad that you're still around to impact because, you know, Jesus always said, even if it's one, that right. young man you're talking to, right. you never know who he may influence. And right. one down the line, it doesn't have to be hundreds.
Right.
It could
right.
just be the one that, as you said, could be a reckoning with. And that's going to enhance the legacy that you mm-hmm. are laying there.
Right, right.
In
right.
conclusion, would you mind letting us know how we would be able to get your music?
My thing is now I'm really trying to get my stuff online now. So I'm really trying to gain more traction now. And prayerfully, the next time I talk to you or before I talk to you, I can call you and tell you that I got some things going on. You know, it is getting some airplay on, I don't know if you heard of it, my boy Pete Rudd, Praise in the Pocket is an international radio station, and he's been playing my stuff. You know,
oh, wonderful.
Yeah, so, and I love that brother because he's been getting a lot of Philly musicians, a lot of exposure, you know. So that's right now, that's the only thing that's happening for me right now. Me doing your show. But I'm just, like I said, I'm just trying to get my wheels going again. I have more material, but I need to sit down with someone with Pro Tools stuff so I can pull some more of my stuff out my hard drive. So
I'm just, well, I'm glad you're still here.
Yeah.
You know, because we're coming at post-COVID and, and the opportunities are beginning to open up. And so you may never know who may contact you and say, how can I be of help? Or for a nominal fee or be able to help you, particularly since you are an unusual instrument right. in the conga. That is really something that even drill teams and, you know, I'm affiliated with the drill team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you see the young men working them drums. Right. I mean, they work them things out. Yeah. But I'm grateful because they're able to get out a lot of that aggression
right.
and a lot of that anger and right. really be focused on their sound, their rhythm, their right. stepping, so forth. So all of those things are great things. And I'm grateful for your input into young people's lives, not only as a teacher, but even in taking one to mentor. Mentoring is so, so key. So for those of us that are listening, you are hearing it straight from the horse's mouth here. And he's not a horse at all. But Mr. Robert Strother, I know him as AKA Bob Conga. You certainly want to reach out to him. Tell them how they can reach out to you if they would like to have you participate for an event or musically or any other way.
Yeah, I am involved right now. We're supposed to start back rehearsal with a 14-piece band called the Children of Adam Band. I am a part of that. We're going to start having outdoor rehearsals.
So, okay.
Because they're trying to go back in the studio and do another CD.
And, okay.
Which I'm pretty much involved in that, vocal-wise and playing percussion and things. So I am involved in that. And you can reach me at, my phone number is 610-416-7944. And my email is Robert, he's a lowercase, Robert_Strother, Strother, @yahoo.com.
All right, y'all heard it right there. Reach out to him. Please leave a message so he can respond to you. If you want to be more detailed, send him an email and he will happily respond. And certainly let us know when you're having your event schedule. So we can let the folks know and share so we can keep in touch. It's been my pleasure to talk with you. I'm so glad you were able to get your time back. And I appreciate you so much, Mr. Bob.
Appreciate you too, Bishop.
Thank you. Have a great afternoon.
You too. All right.
Bye-bye.
How do
Bye-bye.
You feel? How do you feel?
Glad to have with me today my sister, my colleague, and my friend, Dr. DeShonda Williams, who is, besides being an author, a social entrepreneur, she is a mental health expert. Good morning, Dr. Williams. How are you?
Good morning. How are you, Dr. Palmer?
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you for being here on the Bishop Mary Show. May is Mental Health Awareness Month.
Yes.
And your colleague, Dr. Wright, was telling us about availability of resources and ways to identify people in some mental health crises. I wanted to come from a different perspective. He mentioned about the clergy. And being a clergy person yourself, as well as I, often that is not something we really, really want to say. We're having that issue. Historically, we believed in slapping oil, praying, and the demons will leave. But today, it seems more prevalent than ever that we also have to do self-care, and more importantly, mentally. What could you speak to about that?
It's a lot I can speak about it. It's one of my passions, actually, Bishop. In 2015, I was afforded the opportunity to graduate from Palmer Theological Seminary, where I did my research centered around mental health and the church, where I actually interviewed 14 pastors, seven male, seven female. I didn't want to become too gender focused, but that's what I did. And out of the scope of those 14 pastors, I talked about with them how much of self-care do they involve themselves as they are in leadership, as they are pastoring, not just for themselves, but how engaged are they with their parishioners when addressing, teaching, preaching, or even having a discussion about mental health. I think now I can honestly say that was in 2015. It's now 2021. I think there's more conversations centered around the topic of mental health and self-care. I think there's more awareness around how men and women, the clergy, should engage themselves in self-care as opposed as it was when my father and your father was back in the day. I don't think they even knew those two words, self-care, because they were very selfless in caring for the people of the community, simultaneously caring for their families. I think now discussions are being had. I think what's different is how do we approach it? And what ways do we approach it? And how much we are actually assimilating ourselves, right? We do a lot of disseminating. We do a lot of directing. We do a lot of here's resources, here's where you can go. But how much do we actually assimilate ourselves or encourage those who are in leadership to be assimilated with really getting the self-care that they need?
Couldn't we just talk real for a minute? You know, we cannot all share our business.
Right.
Particularly when we are pastors and leaders and people are looking to us. We don't feel there's a safe space for us to be able to say, I'm in trouble, and not become judged. There is the fear of being characterized. There's also the fear that if that gets out in the congregation and the leadership, you might lose the position you hold as pastor. In that case coming before us, what could we put into place, if not already in place, a space where pastors could feel safe enough to say, I need some help?
I really think it's really contextual, honestly, Bishop, because it's really about your social context, right? It's really about who are you engaged with and understanding the intentionality of those relationships, right? I can say for me, I have a safe space where I'm already counseling over 20 pastors, honestly, in the city of Philadelphia that I call, they call me, I give them counseling, they know they can share their challenges with me, their ups and downs.
Excellent.
But I also know as being in this dual relationship, in this dual role, not just as a pastor and leadership and as a clergy, but also as a licensed clinical social worker, I know how to direct them to those resources, right? And so it's a matter about social context. It's a matter about what clergy person or lay person has in their own circle of family and friends that they can feel secure to say, I want to share what's going on in my life, not be afraid about it, be transparent about it, and get that support that they need. I think now one of the things is, I know for me at my fellowship, we try to create a safe space in the sense of we provide the resource to say, here's a fellowship or here's a location where you can get the support that you need, while simultaneously if they're okay with sharing those challenges with me, and I walk them through some steps. There are short steps in terms of maybe 4 to 6 weeks where I help them to navigate some of the confusion that they may be experiencing at that time, but then lead them to that additional resource that they need to get that support. One of the hindrances I do find is that financially, some insurances do not pay for that support services. So that's why I have created within my own niche some mental health friendly churches where I'm linking up psychologists and psychiatrists that I know that can do a sliding scale fee and provide that resource for men and women of clergy.
That's excellent. You know, there was a wave, particularly I think in the last 2-3 years, that we heard more about pastors who committed suicide. And a lot of people attributed that to depression, no self-care, and some mental instability. How is that relatable to the impact that it feeds on us, where we're preaching the parable about the man who had multiple demons? And I've heard it all my life through the Baptist church that Jesus called them out. And once he called out one, he called out many. And so many of us feel as though if I just pray my way through it, if I just seek God's face. The second part of this is there some sin? It's often correlated to some sin in your life if it hasn't left you and you've prayed. Could you talk about the dispelling the myth of that, particularly in the church, and how a church should be able to be aware when someone's coming in with a mental health episode versus a spiritual battle? Because I don't think that a lot of churches know the difference.
Well, one of the things that I enjoy when I do my workshops centered around mental health in the church is that's one of the scriptures that I do use, and as part of the research that I did, where I talked about, you know, the first ministry that Jesus had after collecting the 12 was to encounter a man who had some demonic experiences. One of the things I think that the church has to understand or should understand or learn to understand is that when we're talking about mental health or mental illness, we're talking about someone who has a chemical imbalance in the brain, scientifically. We do not negate the fact that God created a system and this system was disrupted through sin. Because of sin. And because of sin, he had to come back and redeem us and save us and cleanse us with the washing of the blood and, you know, all the good old cliches we have in our Baptist Black church. Sin crept in, and sin had to be abolished. It does not negate the fact that when you are born in 2021, or whether you were born in 1975, or whether you were born in 1776, you can have been born with some hereditary, biological, or environmental traumas that has caused you to either become succumb to a mental illness, or even have had some kind of, again, biological or inheritable illness. Because we know scientifically, we have hereditary people in your family. They always ask you, who's on your mother's line or your daddy's bloodline? Who has schizophrenia? Who has bipolar? We also know environmentally, you can have PTSD because you live in an environment that has 22 homicides within 4 weeks. You would be traumatized, right? And so you'll get depressed. I mean, we all became depressed during the pandemic. It's just that most of us didn't have major depression or chronic depression, but we've all experienced it. You know, research says 1 out of 5 people have a mental health issue. And so when we're talking about the church and we're talking about sin and we're talking about scripture, we need to look at it really and really understand it in this context. This man had demons that was in him. Yes, that is true. Do we correlate to say he had a mental health issue? Because at that time, they didn't identify that as a mental health issue. It's clear. It's very clear that something happened to this man in his life. And these things are the things that I like to highlight. One, his normalcy became abnormal to other people in that context. In other words, those people at that time seeing him walking around butt naked, they thought that was like, okay, that's normal, because that's who he is. Oh, that's him. That's the man with the demons. He's always running around butt naked. So that was abnormal in the context of the setting, but it seemed normal to them because they were used to it. Now, what changed and what shifted was when Jesus met this man. Three things happened to this man.
Come through, girl.
One, the Bible says that after meeting Jesus, he was clothed. Two, he was sitting. And three, he was in his right mind. Now, when we stand up and testify in the Black church, we've always heard, I want to thank God, give an honor to God. I just want to thank God that I'm saved, sanctified, clothed, and in my
right mind. Bye.
What I try to tell people is this. Now, after the people seeing him sitting, talking to Jesus, and clothed and in his right mind, they became afraid. And so this shows me, even then, that when his behavior changed because he met Jesus, the people around him became afraid. It's like even now today, when we see people come into our churches and we're not equipped to understand how to work or cope with someone with a mental health issue, we get afraid. We become afraid because we're not aware. We don't see the signs and the symptoms. And so I tried to educate and empower people. You must be careful that when a woman comes in, it's 99 degrees outside, and she's coming into your church with 22 hats on. I have to be extravagant with this. 22 hats on, 5 coats, a sweater, sweatpants, whatever it is that she layers of clothing, that we don't become afraid. We don't become afraid. That we meet that person where they are, that we introduce to them Jesus, but yes, we let them know, baby, you need to take your Paxil. You need to take your lithium, you need to take your Adderall, whatever it is that you need to take to keep you balanced. But at the same time, we cannot negate the fact that sin has crept into the world. Jesus came to die on the cross for our sins so that we may be free from sin. And this is how you can continue to walk in your freedom when you know that God is on your side, that he sent Jesus to die on the cross for you. At the same time, he has educated and empowered psychologists and psychiatrists in the world of psychology and social work and all those other disciplines to make sure that you have a script So you can go to that CVS or that Rite Aid, or you go to that mental health agency and pick up your medication and take it on a daily basis.
I don't think there's really any difference between those of us that take heart medication, high blood pressure, diabetes, and we have no issue with doing that for the welfare of our physical bodies. And our mind is also a part of our body as our brain is operating to tell us how to function. And so I think that when people make it simple, instead of trying to make it isolated, that it makes it simpler. I tell folks, my father used to say, if I have a heart attack, call 911. Somebody start CPR and then pray. Don't let me lay there saying, Jesus, raise him. You know, God has given us doctors to deal with the immediate situation. And we can continue to pray for wholeness through Jehovah Rapha. That's just a little bit of a sidebar. This will be probably one of my last questions to you. Impact. You mentioned trauma. And particularly for those of us that are in ministry, we encounter trauma not only in the community, within the church, but we are constantly faced with hearing about trauma from those whom we serve. How can we balance that trauma, the impact of it, so that we are still able to serve without mentally because we deal with the trauma, how are we able to safeguard ourselves so we can handle that and still maintain mental health soundness while yet serving?
You know, Bishop, one of the things I do is I practice the discipline of silence, prayer, fasting, and meditation. I think one of the things is that we as leaders, and primarily those that's in clergy positions, we must incorporate that within our daily regimen.
Excellent.
I fast and pray every Monday. Everyone that knows me, I have been doing this for the last 3+ years. Every Monday, every year, I fast and pray. I shut the world out. I meditate. I spend time with God. That's just my mental health day. And I just lay before God all the issues at my heart, all the issues at other people's heart that knows that I go into prayer. That keeps me balanced. And then when I come out of that, I recognize and realize that people are who they are and they're not who they're not. I realize that situations are, it is what it is. It's not what it's not. I cannot do more than what I can do out of the scope of what God gives me the strength to do. I realize that I cannot become anyone else's hero unless I become mine first. And so it's that whole analogy about the whole oxygen mask on the plane. If I cannot help myself, I cannot help someone else. And so when I recognize that the trauma is traumatized, the only thing I can do is not only just say, girl, I'm going to pray for you. Mm-mm. I'm going to empower myself with knowledge and understanding. I'm going to engross myself with areas of things I may not be familiar with just so that I can be relatable to those that I serve. Because a lot of times you hear people say, my pastor don't even know nothing about that. Well, how do you know? Do you ever have a conversation with them? Do you ever talk to them? I'm transparent. Wow. I tell the truth. I've been through some stuff. I've been through some traumatic things. So please do not think that because I'm in leadership that I have not bled before. But I also understand, I taught this on the class the other day, I learned how to lead and not hurt at the same time. And what that means is for me, hurt stands for holding unwanted reoccurring trauma.
Wow.
We have to learn to lead and not hurt. And that means stop holding unwanted reoccurring trauma. Half of this trauma that we see, that we hear, that we experience is not even of our own. It's someone else's trauma. And so how do I become the best for someone else in the capacity that I serve as a leader is by understanding that this trauma, it should not impact me, but I'm not going to be ignorant to the fact that it can take a hold of me. And so what do I do with that? I meditate, I pray, I fast. I seek God. I read, I educate myself, I empower myself, I engage myself with people, like-minded people who want to talk about strategies of how we can combat, how we can destigmatize, and how we can eradicate the social ills of our societies. Not people that just talk about it, but people that just not only talk, but do the walking too. That really does the implementation. I often say we do a lot of conversation, we do a lot of collaboration, but we don't do a lot of implementation. And so you have to have evidence. And so my evidence for me is having the ability to do that. So I like to encourage and empower each person that's in ministry. Find you a discipline. Hone in on that discipline. Let that discipline help rule your universe so that you can be the best of not just for yourself, but for those that you serve and for those that you lead. And the other thing is find you a social system, people that you can talk to and engage with, people that's going to provoke you to wanting to do and be the best for yourself. You know, people that's going to motivate you to want to do something the best for yourself. Because I tell people, you know, Bishop, I tell people, I don't want what's good for me because good would never be good enough. I don't want what's better for me because better would never be good enough. I want what's best. And what's best for me is to take care of myself so I can help take care of somebody else. So I don't have to hurt.
Wow. Man, that was fabulous. I was going to ask you what would be your closing saying, motto, favorite motto, saying that would help somebody who's listening. You know, there are a lot. We could always go scripturally. But if you were to tell somebody who's saying, is it worth me investing in me so I can better serve and then be the best of myself? What would that statement is? What is that go-to for you that when you're really like, oh, I've done the meditation, I'm up to here, I'm over here, what gets you right back? Because once you hear it, you can, you know, as grandma say, pick yourself up, wash your face, blow your nose, and keep it trucking.
I would say to them, remember your purpose. Because if you understand your purpose, you'll understand why you are passionate for the things that you do. A lot of people don't have enough passion because they don't know their purpose. When God said to me, Deshawna, your purpose here on earth is to help heal hurting people. When I know that and I understand it, I realize that all of my experiences, all of my shared experiences, all my personal experiences, I have been through some hurt. But I cannot help heal hurting people had I not experienced that. And so I know my purpose and I know my passion. And I understand that most people don't always respect the methodology of what I do and how I do it. They misinterpret it. They misunderstand it because they don't understand that I understand my purpose. And my purpose is to help heal hurting people. So when you get to that space where you're like, I've already done all that, what else am I supposed to do? Remember your purpose. Remember your passion. Remember why God sent you here. It's only for a while. I tell people, I am an alien. I should have been deported a long time ago. This is not my land. I'm just coming through.
That's right.
Listen, if we are who we say we are, according to the word of God, this is not my land. I'm just coming through. But guess what? I'm still here. I haven't been deported. I haven't been translated or transported somewhere. So I'm still here. And I'm going to do the work of the Lord as much as I can, as long as he has given me breath in my body. So remember your purpose. Remember your purpose.
Thank you, my sister. What a delight to have you on the Bishop Rag Show and to talk about something as a mental health expert, and particularly talking about mental health awareness and where the church is. I appreciate you, and you know it ain't nothing but a holler and a phone call at your sister girl if you need that. And that support and implementation and getting the message out, whether it's motivational speaking, whatever else that I can do, because like you, I know my purpose, and that is to help heal hurting people there too. Little unorthodox, save some souls, much unorthodox, but the result is going to be the same. Now, how would people get in touch with you?
Yes, they can contact me through my email address, which is Dr. Deshawnda, my first name, DeshaWnda, last name Williams, WILLIAMS, the number one, at gmail.com. They also can reach me on Facebook. And once they reach out to me via email, then I will respond to them immediately. And then my team will contact them as well if there's any questions or concerns that they may have.
All right, y'all. Y'all heard it first. She is the daughter of a longtime friend of my daddy, Reverend Dr. Melvin Floyd. We were serving church. She's just below Wayne Junction. Barry Williams, the late Barry Williams, and my dad, the late Reverend Dr. Melvin Floyd. We all came through as PKs.
Yes.
And although they are in glory, probably slapping each other on the back, having a chat, we'll catch them up there one day. Until then, my sister, be encouraged. I thank God for you, and a big hug to you. And we got to hook up so we can just cut up for a few. All right? Yes.
Thank you, Bishop.
May God bless you. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So grateful to have wonderful guests today, our music feature with Bob Conger, but more importantly, to hear from our two dynamic guests, mental health experts, Dr. H. Jean Wright and Dr. Deshawnda Williams, talking about mental health and how we really need to take care of our minds as well as we take care of our bodies. Remember, your mind is a terrible thing to waste, and not taking care of it could cost you more than it's worth. So we want to end today's show with one of Philadelphia's own, Keith Pringle, singing one of my favorite songs, Perfect Peace. You know, in these days and times, even with everything that's going on, you need to have peace. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious unto you. May the Lord lift his countenance upon you and give you peace. Until next time, next week, right here on the Bishop Mary Show. I'm your host, Bishop Mary. Be well and be safe.
Thank you for tuning in to the Bishop Mary Show. To contact Bishop Mary, call 833-722-4748. That's 833-722-4748. And remember, let the healing begin with you. We'll see you the next time on the Bishop Mary Show.